was filled with Gaddafi snipers.
About 200 people were killed by snipers that day. It was a massacre. They were all controlling positions here. We made our entry from that wall. Then, once we were in, we secured the gates.
After 8 hours of heavy fighting, the snipers retreated to the heart of the compound.
No one can describe how it feels. You're knocking on Gaddafi's door in his own house. We used to be so scared. All Libyans know this. You couldn't even park your car or walk near these walls. And we entered this fortress, entered his house and the tunnels he built. We found incredible weapons storage facilities. It's as if Gaddafi invested all of our wealth over 40 years in weapons. What can I tell you? God is great. Thank God. It's just indescribable.
As we return to the main compound, we pass the ruins of one of the buildings flattened by NATO airstrikes earlier this year, a reminder of the many questions regarding international influence that looms in Libya's future. With battles against Gaddafi forces still raging in towns like Beni Walid, Sirte, and Sabha, and with Gaddafi himself still at large, the final fight for Libya and what it will become is far from over. Here, however, standing in his house, people are less concerned about Gaddafi's whereabouts, as imagining for the first time their own futures without him.
Freedom! Goodbye, Gaddafi. This is freedom. Take that, Gaddafi. I'm sitting in your house.
For Democracy Now!, I'm Anjali Kamath with Jackie Suen.
And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a transcript or the video audio podcast of Democracy Now!, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Jessica Lee. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Ryan Devereaux, Dina Guzder, Manal Khan, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Nick Gella, Hugh Grant, Jessel Noor, Jessica Lee, Vesta Gadars. Tomorrow, Michael Moore on our broadcast for the hour. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Bob Longman with your WUSB concert billboard for Monday, September 26th. Steve Malkmus and the Jicks will be at Terminal 5 in Manhattan at 8 p.m. Your concert billboard for Tuesday, September 27th. Mogwai will be at Webster Hall in Manhattan at 6:30 p.m. That's the rescheduled show from April 22nd. George Thorogood and the Destroyers will be at B.B. King's in Manhattan at 8 p.m. Foster the People with Reptar will be at Terminal 5 in Manhattan at 7 p.m. And the Badass Girl Rock Fest featuring Mansi will be at the Knitting Factory Brooklyn at 6 p.m. Here on campus, Stony Brook, Te Vaka, and Kawamakaiwa Kanakaole will be at the Wang Center at 7 p.m. And Yoko Ono, Imagine Peace, featuring John and Yoko's Year of Peace, will be at the Stoller Center for the Arts at the University Art Gallery in Stony Brook University, 12 to 4, until October 15th. Your concert billboard for Wednesday, September 28th. George Thorogood and the Destroyers will be at B.B. King's at 8 p.m. Swans and Sir Richard Bishop will be at Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn at 9 p.m. And Radiohead will be at the Roseland Ballroom in Manhattan September 28th and 29th. That's Wednesday and Thursday.
That's today's concert billboard. Tune in to WUSB every day to hear who's playing where in the area. Or go to WUSB.fm and see the concert list with your own eyes to see now and for months to come. Or the most up-to-date info on the Facebook group at WUSB Concert Billboard. And where can you hear all this music? 90.1 FM, WUSB, Stony Brook.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. Time is 6:02. Time once again for Off the Wall. We'll be right back.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined once again by Kyle.
Good evening.
Fighting the demons tonight, aren't we?
Yes, the demons are about.
Exercising the radio station demons, and there are plenty of them. But I think we've gotten through the majority of it.
Well, they're familiar demons, and we know how to get around them. And I think other people would give up. They'd throw up their arms. They wouldn't come in. They walk out of the station. I don't think they would be able to handle it.
I gave up. I walked out of the station. You had to call me back.
Well,
I was halfway to the parking lot.
Right.
Thanks for that, I guess, but...
Well, I think the show's better with you here.
There are those who would debate that. But let's hear from some people who might not debate that. These are some of our loyal listeners, the ones who know how to write a letter. I'm not saying a lot of our listeners don't know how to write letters, but do you? Do you actually write letters? Do you send email to otw@2600.com? Do you do that?
You gotta ask yourself, people.
Mm-hmm. That's otw@2600, the numbers, dot, little period, and com.
And
those
people,
magical things will work.
People still read. I mean, they read. When you write, people read. It's not all perceived as spam. It's amazing. If you write something, try it sometime.
Not
if
many
you,
people read anymore. That's the thing. That's
why
bookstores are closing. That's why libraries are being foreclosed upon.
Right. That's what makes it, you differentiate yourself by writing something. You write it down, you know, the whole freedom of speech, that whole thing, and then you send it. That's kind of fun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the post office, make them feel useful so they don't go out of business, and then you know, you wonder if they got it.
They can't send email through the post office, though.
Well, yeah, okay, but you can also send email. That's fun. You know, you
well,
send it.
What would
it,
happen if you put otw@2600.com on an envelope and dropped it in a mailbox? I wonder where it would go. Would somebody somewhere eventually try to send that to us via email?
Maybe back to the sender.
What if there was no sender? Or what if the sender was another email address?
Oh, what if the post office? What if they started this thing where their automatic things read the
uh-huh.
email address on the letter,
uh-huh.
sent it into another machine,
yeah.
it cuts open the letter, scans the letter,
uh-huh.
then OCRs it into text, and then the post office forwards it electronically?
What if there are things inside the envelope, like little gifts or stamps or trinkets of some sort?
It takes a JPEG of that. And
no, it gets
it
a MakerBot,
envelope.
And it makes a replica of it, and emails that. No, it emails you the MakerBot code, and you have a MakerBot
right,
at home.
Right, the G code, and then you download it, and you make it in plastic.
Uh huh.
And then if you want, you can get it forwarded in another little box. No, this could save.
Well,
USPS.
You say plastic. The MakerBot that we're talking about, yes, that can only do plastic. But the new MakerBot, the one that's coming out next year, has another new maker. It can do plastic and gold. Those two things. So. Everything that the new MakerBot will be making will be half plastic, half gold. I read that on the internet.
I didn't hear about that.
Yeah,
yet.
You should read the internet more.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's going to be, it'll turn things around.
But yeah, check it out, people. If you write something and then you send it, whether it's email or traditional mail, it will go somewhere and someone might read it.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, we'll read it. And
yeah.
If it's pointed, it might be reread on the air.
That's right.
Yeah.
I had wanted to read the letters on the air tonight, but we're out of time because we spent so much time talking about mailing letters in the first place that we just ran right out. I'm sorry about that. But maybe if you write us again, we'll read your letter.
No, you should read it. No, read
I'm
it just anyway.
Waving
if you didn't
at
take
me.
That much
all right,
time,
all right, I'll read
two
it.
Minutes.
You two know,
minutes.
I come in here, I march out, I come back in, I'm still being bossed around.
No, E, that is the time we could have spent complaining about equipment at this radio station.
Could have spent time doing
yeah,
that.
But
still...
we were talking about solutions for the United States Postal Service because we are proud Americans. And the post office is an American institution.
Is it, though? Is
yeah,
it really?
It's like the Pony Express. I mean, it's as American
I go
as
in
pumpkin
there,
pie.
I go in there, you know, and despite the flags and despite the wall posters with troops and despite the postal clerks asking if I want to donate money to the war causes and despite all the pictures of nature and the map of the 50 states, I just don't feel like I'm in the United States. I just don't. Something about it. They just could do more, I think, to make it feel like they're part of the USA.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what.
Huh.
Maybe have, like, fries or something. You know, something American like French fries in the lobby.
Yeah. You know, I heard those machines that actually read and interpret the addresses are offshore anyway. Maybe they could bring those jobs back here.
What, you mean they send the letters offshore? To
no, they send pictures of the handwritten addresses, and if the machine can't interpret it to route the letter, it's interpreted by someone in another country.
What do they do with the letter
American
while it's being
jobs overseas?
Wait, while it's being USPS. Interpreted. What while it's being interpreted? What happens to the letter? The actual
it's
letter.
It's in limbo or something.
But where? Who's holding on to it and saying, "Oh, let's wait for this person in the Philippines or whatever to figure out what we're trying to say and get back to us." Someone's holding on. I mean, that person could be trying to figure out what it says.
No, I think it sits in some machine in like a hopper or something. I mean, it already has a barcode on the bottom by then, maybe.
Okay.
But I think you should read this letter because it sounds like it's important.
But we don't have any more time. Again, we spent time talking about the letters themselves without actually reading the letters.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Letters are so exciting.
We only have 4 seconds left in the theme.
Okay,
OTH. And the theme is like 20 minutes long.
OTH at 2600.com.
It's over now.
Oh, man. So it's just us?
Well, yeah, and there's no justice in that. Let's try and get through the letters. We won't be able to read all of them, but we'll try. OTW at 2600.com. Did we mention that's our email address?
Oh, I'm sorry. OTW.
That stands for Off the Wall.
Off the Wall.
That's the name of this show. I don't know why. We don't make these decisions. Okay. As a fan of OTW and Mr. Goldstein, I wondered if there was a chance of shaking his hand when he records the next show in Denmark. We don't often have such a unique visitor, signed Katil. Well, I'm sorry to say, I think, Katil, you might have gotten wrong information because, yes, Kyle and I were, in fact, in Denmark last December.
Yes, we were.
But we didn't air the show until sometime this year, probably just a few weeks ago. So it might have appeared to you that we were on our way to Denmark at that point, but it was merely a magnetic recording that we were playing. It wasn't even magnetic anymore, I don't think. It's digital.
Yeah,
but
it was digital.
It's a digital recording of something we did in the past, and unfortunately we can't go back in time.
Yeah, so that's our travels that are now being broadcast. We put together some audio while we were on the road, and so it sounds like he enjoyed the show and would like to shake your hand.
He might have enjoyed us saying that the show was going to air next week. He might have enjoyed that, and not so much the show. Or there were actually two shows in Denmark, so maybe he enjoyed the first show and was hoping to enjoy the second.
Well, you know what? You may be right. Maybe he hasn't heard the show yet, and he's thinking that, but it's really in the past.
I think he's heard both shows, and right now is cursing our very names because we misled him.
Yeah. Well, I think he still wants to shake your hand and compliment you on the good work that you do here.
But he's going to have one of those buzzer things in his hand when he does my hand. You know, those things? Yeah.
That'll get you going.
You know, Spiny Norman has one of those.
I bet.
Yeah. Sometimes we see Spiny Norman after the show, and he always gets us with that little lapel flower thing. You know, hey, lean into this. Look at that. I fall for it every time.
He's a prankster.
Yeah, he certainly is. Okay, here's another letter. This is from Didier. You know what? I practice pronouncing this. D-I-D-I-E-R. How do you say that?
Didier. Sounds French.
Yeah, it is French.
Didier.
Or it could be Belgian French.
Didier. Oh, man.
Yeah, it could be. It could be Canadian French.
I got a good story about that.
It could be New Orleans French. It could be all kinds of Frenches. Anyway, I don't agree with you. Belarus is not the last dictatorship in Europe. Vatican City is one, too. They don't have democracy. Well, this Frenchman has some issues with the Vatican, apparently.
Enough said.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to know, does anyone actually live in Vatican City? You know, I mean, I know the Pope probably has a crash base there, but...
Define live.
Are there citizens, people who would march up against the dictatorship or whatever it is that you call it over there? Or is it just pretty much a place where people go to do church-like things and then go back home and do non-church-like things?
Work Pope security.
Yeah. You know, when I went there, I saw a priest walking around with briefcases. And I was asking myself, what is in that briefcase? What does a priest go back and forth to the Vatican with a briefcase for? What could they be doing? Accounting work or keeping track of where certain properties are or filing liens and taxes on the serfs? Or I don't know. I don't know what they do. I'm ignorant. I'm admitting my ignorance. Mm. I just saw a priest with a briefcase, and it kind of freaked me out.
Well, they've got papers. They've got their diocese to represent. He could have been an out-of-town priest. You don't know. I mean, if he was a local, then maybe he commutes and has a pencil-pushing job there.
But
I don't know.
Kind of, what paperwork is there? You simply stand up in front of the flock, and you say the words and, you know, give out the wine, the bread, and all that, and then it's on to another day.
There's litigation, there's lawsuits, there's restitution, and
well,
the victim's
true.
Families.
Yeah,
you got
okay.
a lot
of that going on. That's
a lot
true.
Of paperwork.
Mm. Okay, maybe that was what it was all about.
Sure.
Here's another letter. This one is from Dino. I think it's pronounced Dino. It could be Diano. D-E-A-N-O.
Dino?
A lot of interesting names that begin with D.
These are great, though. Keep going. All right, Dino.
I would like to say I really enjoy listening to all the radio programs that you've been involved in, active programs included, and I would be off the wall, off the hook. Mm. I started to listen to the Chatterbox program. Now, okay, I should point out, way back in my history, we did The Voice of Long Island, and we recently put all those online, and that was followed, I think, in 1983 by an afternoon talk show in this very room,
you know,
with this very equipment that wasn't working then either. I'm sorry. I'll sit back down. I'm sorry, just getting off in a little tirade there.
It's okay. We understand where you're coming from.
But I did an afternoon talk show then called Chatterbox, and that's what he's referring to.
You know what I heard about Volai is that the dates line up. You know how you released
it? You said Volai, Voice of Long Island, for people who aren't so sophisticated to actually make a word out of the initials. Volai.
Right, yes. What I said, Voice of Long Island.
Yes.
I heard that the dates line up, just the way you released it. That was really cool. You did the countdown, and every week, and I guess this year, coincidentally or not coincidentally, whatever, they line up again.
Well, here's what happened. It was about maybe 2.5 years ago, I think February of 2009, that we started not re-airing The Voice of Long Island, but simply putting it up online at the time that it aired.
Right.
That lined up perfectly day, month, with what happened in 1981. Mm-hmm. So that ended, because the show ended in the early part of 1983, so that ended in the early part of 2011. But what happened was I returned to the airwaves. I still remember the parade. It was really something. I returned to the airwaves in September. Yeah, it was something. It really was. The governor was here. Reagan even stopped by. He just passed by. He waved from his car. So there was that big ceremony, and the new show Chatterbox began. Okay, what this listener is saying, I started to listen to the Chatterbox program. I noticed that the first show aired September 5th, 1983. I thought that it was cool to listen to a show that aired years ago on the same day as the present. So now I can do that with Chatterbox. Isn't that something? So, yesterday was a Monday. And there was
so you're saying not only Voice of Long Island, but also Chatterbox lines up?
Well, it can just keep going. It's going to keep lining up. 1983 is always going to line up with 2011. 1984 will line up with 2012. That's how it's going to work for quite a while.
Well, thank you, Diana, for pointing that out.
But he goes on.
Sorry.
Additionally, you can listen to the same day shows of the Ministry of Truth, which is the show that followed Chatterbox. It was an evening talk show. And that begins on March 29th. Of 1984, but also lines up with March 29th of 2012. Brain Damage, the long-running show that followed that was the two-hour talk show that had a cult following, and that started in 1988, but he points out that you can start listening to that in sequence. The dates will line up on January 2nd, 2016. Boy, I really don't want the world to end in 2012, he says. Keep up the great work. I look forward to seeing you all next year at Hope. And that's true. There will be a Hope next year.
Hope
number 9.
July 13th, 14th, and 15th?
Yes. Friday the 13th, Saturday the 14th, Sunday the 15th.
2012.
Hope being Packers on Planet Earth, and it's our 9th conference in New York City at the Still Standing Hotel, Pennsylvania. Details soon to be posted, so you heard it here, maybe first.
And get your tickets early.
Now, here's one more letter. This one's a long one. We'll read this one, then we'll move on to other things. Hi, Emmanuel. During the most recent off-the-wall broadcast, which is not the most recent off-the-wall broadcast anymore because I printed this out a few weeks ago, you had asked listeners to chime in if they still read actual tree-sourced books. Unfortunately, due to my job schedule and commute, I can't listen live, so I'm sending you this email. I'm proud to say that my wife and I are both into the real thing. Between my wife and me, we own and continue to buy, it must be several hundred books. And between my wife and me, we own a grand total of two electronic books, too. One is a digital copy that came with a physical hard copy book I bought when I prepped for the CompTIA A+ certification test. The other is an electronic version of the Java programming book required for a class I'm taking in pursuit of my MS in software engineering. To be honest with you, each book has just verified for me that there are few advantages of electronic books over real books. It was nice to load up the PDF version of the A+ prep book onto my cell phone so I could study during my daily commutes on the Chicago L trains, so overcrowded that there's no elbow room for a full-size book. But you better believe that at home I was prepping with the paper-based book and, quite frankly, having a much easier time with it. So that's number one. Number two, the electronic version of my Java textbook You want to hit the record button first. Yes, I'm sorry. And then you hit the play button.
I've learned so much here at the radio station.
Okay, now hit the play button quickly before the machine breaks again.
Oh, my God.
All right.
See, this is why we run these demons. They think they can rear their heads, but they can't. They can't beat us.
I think the secret with that machine is that it shouldn't always be on.
You have to turn things off.
Unlike a real radio station where equipment can stay on, this one, you have to let the equipment rest.
Get some chill time.
Turn off the transmitter every now and then. Turn off the microphone. Right. Definitely turn off the microphone. Turn off the record players and shut down the lights.
All right, pardon the interruption.
Yes, I'm sorry. Sorry for everybody. Number two, advantages to electronic books over real books. The electronic version of my Java textbook cost about half the price of the old school version. It was even considerably cheaper than any used copies I could find. And I'm sure that even free copies could be found on BitTorrent sites, should I have wanted to seek out the option of dubious legality. Number three, I discovered one more advantage when doing my Java homework. An assignment we were given unexpectedly required us to do a little bit of research outside the chapters we were studying. The search function helped me find exactly what I needed in the untapped chapters, while many of my classmates were struggling looking for the info. But that's it. I would go on about why I'm sticking to real, honest-to-goodness books, but a recent issue of 2600 had an excellent article about that. I was surprised to hear you and Kyle talk about going to Borders, as I thought they were gone completely. At least the ones here in Chicago are, and now, sadly enough, the one here is gone, too.
Yeah, we went by there, and there's a guy sitting in a couch, like, doing security. Or he's just sitting, watching one of the old TVs in front of the door, working security. I hope he doesn't get busted for saying that.
Thinking that maybe he actually is just crashing there.
Maybe
it's a squat now, squat.
You could be right. I didn't ask it. I mean, he was inside. He had the door locked, and he was polishing his gun. So.
They really should do something with all the empty stores around here. Give them to people that need homes, or let them fix up the place. Give it to them. Let them actually own it. It's not doing anybody any good. We just have all these. You know, I went. I don't want to name anybody by name, but I went to get an item the other day. The store that we went to, remember this? It was one store in a big shopping center. It was the only one that was still left. The three cars in this massive parking lot. And this shopping center has never done well. And it was basically built over the objections of people who didn't want to see more trees torn down for something we don't need.
Whoever invented the strip mall was just so off base.
Yeah. And now that the strip malls are there, either we tear them down and replace them with forest like it should be, or we put something else in the buildings that exist now. And something that is needed. You know, you match one thing with another. People need homes, you give them home. Of course, living in an old Sears probably isn't the best thing to do. But I'm sure you can modify things and get people. If you tell somebody, this is now yours, this is now belongs to your community, I'll bet you'll see all kinds of things, all kinds of imaginative projects.
Yeah.
Give it to hackers. Make it a big hacker space.
Right.
You know? Why not? Every abandoned store is now a hacker space. How about that?
Yeah.
I think you'll see some cool things.
Yeah, some really cool things that benefit the community around it. And I reiterate, whoever thought of a strip mall, when was that ever a good idea? They're ugly, they're seedy, they're tacky. What good is a strip mall?
No good.
They're foul. They're not timeless. They don't blend into anything.
They're awful.
It's just disgusting. Anyway, go on.
How did we get into this?
We're visiting the old Borders.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yes. I was surprised to hear you and Kyle talk about going to Borders, as I thought they were gone completely. At least the ones here in Chicago are. The ones everywhere now are. A while ago, it was announced that the flagship Borders store on Michigan Avenue was closing down due to disputes with the landlord. It took over a year for that store to close. But of course, when it did close, it was right before the announcement that all Borders stores in Chicago except one or two would close. Just a week or two ago, my wife and I were walking along Michigan Avenue and saw that one of those Forever 21-type stores was about to open in its place literally the very next day. And we already have literally two Forever 21 stores less than two blocks away from each other. Is that a chain, Forever 21?
Yes, it's the premier chain of choice for 13-year-old hoochie mamas everywhere.
I see. Okay, well, that's good to know. I sarcastically said how it wanted to come back for its grand opening. How I wanted to come back for its grand opening. I noticed that one of the letters in its sign was already burnt out the day before it opened. Why did Borders go out? Surely you can blame ebooks, but if that were the case, we wouldn't still have Barnes & Noble. I'll tell you why Borders is soon to be no more. They just plain started to suck. Practically overnight, the CDs and DVDs were moved out of some stores and replaced with, God help me, a wrapping paper and gift bag section. My wife is a high school teacher, and because there wasn't enough money in the budget to order copies of a book she needed her students to have, She went around to all the bookstores in town. We have a ton of indie and used places, including Borders. She saw that Borders' in-store database said there were copies likely in store. She couldn't find the book, so she asked for help. The Borders clerk checked the employee-only database, which actually gives useful information, whether or not the book actually is in the store instead of this likely crap, where in the store it is, how many copies there are, everything you need to know. The guy saw on the computer that they had 20 copies of the book in the store, but they were in the back of the store and needed to be unboxed. Did he offer to go back and or have someone else go back and get the books? No. Instead, he offered to call a Borders store in a nearby suburb to see if they had any copies out in the stacks. Wow. I don't know how things are in your neck of the woods, but here in Chicago, we have indie, new and used bookstores all over the place, at least one in every neighborhood. Ditto record stores to a lesser extent, and thankfully, they've always thrived, and now with Borders gone, they're doing better than ever. Anyway, I have until Wednesday night to finish my Java homework, so I'm going to do that now, then close the ebook, then continue enjoying a most excellent recent addition to my real book library, Ghost in the Wires by Kevin Mitnick. Signed, Sean. Thanks, Sean, for that wonderful letter.
That was good. I had one comment. I think there's no replacement for searching, thumbing through a textbook and searching for things, because it reinforces other things that, you know, yeah, it takes more time, but it reinforces other things you've already read, and I think that's part of the learning process. So I get that search might be beneficial, but I could see, and I'm not saying this just to be difficult and old school and analog and whatever, but I do think that that's part of learning and studying, is that you got to flip through, you got to read stuff you've already read five times to find that one thing. And that's how you search, your brain works. You go, oh, I remember that. It's in between these five other things that I already know.
Yeah, there are shortcuts. There really aren't shortcuts for that kind of thing. You got to, you know, go back and say, okay, I think it was around here somewhere. And that way you have a full understanding of what it is that you've been looking at.
Reading comprehension.
I'm just afraid a lot of people won't ever get that.
Yeah, but that was a good letter.
It is. Now, the thing is, there aren't independent bookstores everywhere. Certainly not a lot around here anymore. They were all driven out by the chains. Hopefully they'll open up again, because there is nothing like a bookstore, a real bookstore. You know, one with a cat and one with a lot of copies of old books or new books, or just someone with a knowledge of reading in the front and someone you can talk to. And we need to make sure those places continue to exist. There are a lot of people around saying what I consider to be really ignorant things, like, okay, let's get all the dead tree books out of the mainstream and shut down all the bookstores and we'll just go digital.
Right, we were just talking about this. It's a binary. It's either or.
Mm-hmm.
It's either all digital or it's all paper tree. There's no...
Yeah. Doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be that way. And these quote-unquote dead tree books, they survive for a long, long time. And it's a good thing. Digital, not so much.
You know, I work on cars every now and then, and I one time was working in a repair shop, and for a particular model of car, we only had the manual on a CD or a DVD, and it was very tricky to be flipping through on a laptop to try to see where the parts are and stuff. But having that book and just being able to thumb through and actually look at the diagrams and the steps, and yeah, you get your greasy fingers all over the pages and stuff, but it's right there. You can have it on the hood of the car or in the engine compartment, and there's something about that, you know, not needing a cable connected to it or a battery or, oh my gosh, if I drop the book, I could throw the book across the shop, you know, and then go pick it up and read how I want to do the next procedure, you know. And you got to be so dainty and careful with a computer. Now I know not every shop uses laptops, but that's my point, you know, that analog book is useful, and there's a reason that, I don't know, it's portable. It doesn't...
And you do need to throw it across the shop sometimes.
Absolutely.
Because you get frustrated, and you can't do that as easily with a laptop.
Right.
Without having to pay a lot of money to fix it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's not be too hasty and just simply assume that whatever is in vogue these days is going to be better for us necessarily in the long run.
Or that we can't have both.
Yeah, I mean, these are things that have existed for centuries, many centuries, and it's how history is passed down. You know, you can change an electronic document fairly easily. It's been done. You can change a news story, but you can't change a newspaper. You can't change what's actually written. In the book 1984, that's precisely what they were doing. They were finding copies of things that they wanted to change the history of and burning them, destroying them, because that was the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Digitally, yeah, you can simply go out and replace all instances of a particular phrase, pull back a story, do you recall the Kindle pulled back, ironically enough, George Orwell titles, because they didn't have the right, apparently, to sell them, so they simply took them all back, and people who thought they had them no longer had them. You can't do that with a book. When a book is out, it's out.
Yeah. So, because this direction is inevitable, and people can't have both, it's on you. You have got to choose one book, and you become that book, and when the rest are burning, we all move away and represent the last of all the books.
That sounds so sad, but there's definitely truth in that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't shy away from the new things. Learn about the new things, too, by all means. You can have feet in both worlds. You know, it's a good thing to be aware, but also to understand the past and why that's important as well. Okay, so last week we were talking about Troy Davis, and unfortunately, and I will say unfortunately, they went ahead with the execution last Wednesday. They delayed it a couple of hours just to torture the guy even more. I never really doubted that they would go ahead in the first place, because this is what the legal system in this country does. They believe that they're infallible. They don't turn back. They don't second guess themselves. And to them, that's a sign of strength. That's a sign of emphasizing how good they are. Unfortunately, an innocent person may very well have been killed as a result of that. Now, Troy Davis may be dead, but his execution last Thursday in the American state of... I'm reading a European story here, so... Did it happen on Thursday? Did they delay it that long? That it was after midnight? I think it was more like 10 o'clock or something. I'm not really sure, but last week...
It was East Coast time, though. It was in Georgia.
Yeah, it was in Georgia.
So I think it was around midnight, but it was delayed such that they could say it was the next day. Because I read a lot of... my theory.
But. Here's the thing. This story came from CNN, and it says both Wednesday and Thursday. I'll read it the way they have it.
Sure.
So you can hear how journalists don't always get it right either. Mm. Troy Davis may be dead, but his execution Thursday in the American state of Georgia has made him the poster boy for the global movement to end the death penalty. World figures, including Pope Benedict XVI, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, human groups and commentators? What's a human group? I think they meant to say human rights groups, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because most groups have humans in them. Commentators urged the execution to be halted, but to no avail. On Wednesday, Davis was put to death by lethal injection for the 1989 killing of off-duty police officer Mark McPhail, despite doubts being raised over the conviction. The execution sparked angry reactions and protests in European capitals, as well as outrage on social media. Isn't it kind of ironic that European capitals were more upset than American capitals about this? I think that really says a lot. We strongly deplore that the numerous appeals for clemency were not heeded, the French Foreign Ministry said. There are still serious doubts about his guilt, said Germany's junior minister for human rights, Markus Löning. An execution is irreversible. A judicial error can never be repaired. The European Union expressed deep regret over the execution, repeated its call for a universal moratorium on capital punishment. It's like night and day, Europe and here. Do you know, over in Europe, they have massive demonstrations against governments because they want the governments to spend more on social programs. And here we have your Tea Partiers going around getting everybody to agree with them on cutting all social programs. And basically just spending all the money on military and nothing for people. And it's incredible how healthcare, bad thing, you know, social programs, awful. We must stop them immediately. Over there, it's completely different. I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong. I'm just saying that it's different and we should look at the differences. EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton said the bloc had learned with deep regret that Mr. Troy Davis was executed. The EU opposes the use of capital punishment in all circumstances and calls for a universal moratorium. The abolition of that penalty is essential to protect human dignity. Amnesty International condemned the execution in a statement. The U.S. justice system was shaken to its core as Georgia executed a person who may well be innocent. Killing a man under this enormous cloud of doubt is horrific and amounts to a catastrophic failure of the justice system, they said. In Britain's Guardian newspaper, Ed Jackson reported before the execution took place, gave 10 reasons why he believed the execution should not take place. Actually, no, they got that story wrong, too. His name's not Ed Jackson. He was in Jackson, Georgia. His name is Ed Pilkington, because I have his piece right here. Okay, you know, I'm gonna abandon this story because there's just too many problems with it, and go to his 10 reasons. Listen to these 10 reasons. I'll go through them pretty quickly. Of the 9 witnesses who appeared at Davis's 1991 trial who said they had seen Davis beating up a homeless man in a dispute over a bottle of beer and then shooting to death a police officer, 7 have since recanted their evidence. 7 out of 9 recanted their evidence. Indisputable fact. Number 2, one of those who recanted, Antoine Williams, subsequently revealed they had no idea who shot the officer and that they were illiterate, meaning they could not read the police statements that they had signed at the time of the murder in 1989. Others said they had falsely testified that they had overheard Davis confess to the murder. Number 3, many of those who retracted their evidence said that they had been coerced by the police, threatened by the police, into testifying against Davis. They were threatened with being put on trial themselves if they did not cooperate. You believe that kind of thing doesn't happen? Happens all the time. Look at the actions of the police on Wall Street the last couple of days, what they've been doing to people. Spraying pepper spray at peaceful demonstrators for no reason. There's video of this. If there wasn't video, they'd deny it ever happened. And how many times have we caught police in lies? How many times? Give people authority, they will abuse it. That's a fact. Number 4, of the 2 of the 9 key witnesses who have not changed their story publicly, a lot of people ask about this, and legitimately so. There are 9 witnesses, 7 recanted their story. What about the 2 that didn't? Well, one has kept silent for the past 20 years and refuses to talk. The other is named Sylvester Coles. Now, Sylvester Coles was the man who first came forward to police and implicated Davis as the killer, but over the past 20 years, evidence has grown that Coles himself may be the gunman. And he was fingering Davis to save his own skin. So do you really expect him to recant his testimony?
I don't.
No, yeah, I don't either. And the other guy, you know, maybe he's like locked in his house somewhere and he needs to, he hasn't said a word in 20 years about this. And who knows what he's said about anything recently. Number 5, in total, 9 people have come forward with evidence that implicates Coles. Most recently, last Monday, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles heard from Kiana Glover, who told the panel that in June 2009, she had heard Coles, who had been drinking heavily, confess to the murder of McPhail. Number 6, apart from the witness evidence, most of which has since been cast into doubt, there was no forensic evidence gathered that links Davis to the killing. None. Not one bit. Number 7, in particular, there is no DNA evidence of any sort. The human rights group, the Constitution Project, points out that 3/4 of those prisoners who have been exonerated and declared innocent in the U.S. were convicted at least in part on the basis of faulty eyewitness testimony. And let me just break away from the story for a moment to go to another story that'll give you an idea. In the year 2000, Frank Lee Smith is exonerated 11 months after he died. And 14 years after being convicted of raping and murdering an 8-year-old girl, the eyewitnesses were wrong. 2001, Charles Fain is exonerated and set free 18 years after being sentenced to death for the kidnapping, rape, and murder of a young girl. The scientific testimony was wrong. 2002, Ray Crone is exonerated, set free 10 years after being sentenced to death for the kidnapping, rape, and murder of a bar worker. Scientific testimony, again, was wrong. 2003, John Thompson exonerated, set free 18 years after being sentenced to death for murder. The prosecutors hit exculpatory scientific evidence, and the eyewitnesses were wrong. 2004, Ryan Matthews is exonerated, set free 5 years after being sentenced to death for killing a convenience store owner. The eyewitnesses, again, wrong. 2008, Kennedy Brewer exonerated, set free 7 years after being sentenced to death for killing his girlfriend's 3-year-old daughter. Scientific testimony, wrong. 2010, Anthony Graves exonerated, set free 18 years after being sentenced to death for the murder of an entire family. The sole witness, who was himself the murderer, lied. So, those are the most famous. Mistakes are made. Mistakes are made frequently, often. And why is this any different? Okay, number 8. No gun was ever found connected to the murder. Coles later admitted that he owned the same type of .38 caliber gun that had delivered the fatal bullets, but that he had given it away to another man earlier on the night of the shooting. Number 9, higher courts in the U.S. have repeatedly refused to grant Davis a retrial on the grounds that he had failed to, quote, prove his innocence, unquote. His supporters counter that where the ultimate penalty is at stake, it should be for the courts to be beyond any reasonable doubt of his guilt. And finally, number 10, even if you set aside the issue of Davis's innocence or guilt, the manner of his execution is cruel and unnatural. If the execution goes ahead as expected, it would be the fourth scheduled execution date for this prisoner. In 2008, he was given a stay just 90 minutes before he was set to die. And experts in death row say such multiple experiences with imminent death is tantamount to torture. These are all facts. These are things I don't think we can argue with. But even if you do argue with them, surely you can admit that there is some doubt here. There is significant doubt. There's a significant lack of real evidence. But when you have a guilty verdict, oftentimes that's enough to satisfy people. And if you have so much blind faith in the system, even without having the evidence, even without having access to the true facts or questioning the doubters, that closure is all you want. And you don't care. You just want someone to pay. You want someone to pay the price. And I think that's why people in that position are so adamant about moving ahead and not wanting to hear any other side.
Yeah, and they don't want to consider the precedents that it's setting or that it's reinforcing. And that's how our system works. When things are just let go and people don't change it, it repeats itself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's just, I can never quite get over the logic. You know, you have a system where someone's either in prison or they're killed. Well, if you kill them, that's it. That's the end of the story. And if they're in prison, if there is some kind of a mistake that was made,
mm-hmm.
there at least is the opportunity, not for full amends to be made, because every single one of the people we just listed really should become instant millionaires, I think, for having been treated this way, having lost a good part of their lives to the system. But at least they can try and live a normal life after this horrendous thing has happened to them. We've all seen this. We've all seen miscarriages of justice where innocent people are put in the wrong place. We see it in movies all the time, but we see it in real life too. You know, I was accused of something in second grade by my second grade teacher that I didn't do. And that was probably my first instance of, wow, it doesn't matter what the truth is sometimes. If somebody believes you're guilty, you're guilty. Now, I wasn't sentenced to death for that, but it was still traumatic. And I was able to tell the story and have some people believe me. Now, imagine that you don't have that opportunity and that you're paying the ultimate price and no one's listening. You know, it's a very Kafkaesque type of a scenario. And that's the thing I cannot get, that it was so obvious. It was so obvious that there were doubts. Why is that not enough to at least put a hold on this, to erase those doubts once and for all?
That's what makes people crazy. That's what makes them run.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I've been reading this Mitnick book about ghosts in the wires. Same situation. You know, when you're accused, when you're up against a system that is not just,
mm-hmm.
it you have two choices: to be driven mad by the injustice and be sacrificed at the hands mm-hmm. of that injustice, or you flee, or whether that's in a cell, you know, going loony, or physically leave the country, get out. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And that doesn't resolve anything anymore. In fact, could cause you more problems.
Well, the Mitnick case is a good example. Certainly nowhere near the ultimate penalty, but
no.
As far as why would somebody run from authorities, especially if they had nothing to hide or if they weren't that much of a criminal, why would someone do that? Well,
I was speaking to your example, second grade, you know.
Yeah.
There's plenty more thereafter, you know.
I know we're having, you know, rather minor examples here, but I've seen worse examples.
Sure.
And I know of worse examples where people have been imprisoned for things that complete nonsense and nobody will believe them. Nobody will even consider the possibility that they might be innocent or at least not as guilty as they were made out to be. Now, you know, in fairness, I think to understand these things, you should look at the other side. You should analyze the other side. So I want to look at another article entitled "Troy Davis's Claims of Innocence: Smoke and Mirrors," and this appeared today actually on a blog called Heritage.org. Troy Davis, convicted cop killer, and okay, I'm going to stop every now and then just to insert my comments, and feel free, Kyle, to do the same.
Okay.
Convicted cop. Now, of course, when you say convicted cop killer, that makes up people's minds right there.
Right.
Convicted cop killer. I mean, you know. Okay, but to those people, I say, you know what? O.J. Simpson is innocent. So what do you think about that? You know, your great court system there makes decisions. Are you going to say that? Are you going to be happy to meet O.J. Simpson in an alley someplace at some point? Well, I know he's in jail now, but if he wasn't in jail, he's an innocent man. He's a completely innocent man. But most people don't seem to believe that. So, you know, maybe the court system isn't always as infallible. And should O.J. Simpson, I don't want to pick on O.J. Simpson too much because bad things happen to people that do that. But if do we append innocent man after O.J. Simpson every time we mention his name? Do we do that?
Right.
Well, Troy Davis, convicted cop killer. You append that, you're painting an image and basically making your argument before you even make the argument.
And that's on you. As the media, you can't pass judgment like that. You got to really, ethically speaking, you got to be careful what you say.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't be putting that in people's minds, in the consciousness of the community, when something's ongoing and it has not legally been resolved.
Although they will argue that it has legally been resolved as soon as the trial is over. But, you know, there are trials that don't hear all the evidence. Things do change, and just because the gavel comes down does not mean it's over. We're human beings, mm-hmm. and we are supposed to be somewhat flexible in our beliefs.
Go on.
We only read 5 words of this story, so let's try and get through more of it. Mm-hmm. Troy Davis, convicted cop killer, was executed last week by the state of Georgia for the 1989 slaying of Officer Mark McPhail. Anti-death penalty activists held Davis out as an innocent man and repeatedly claimed that 7 of the 9 witnesses to the cold-blooded murder, again, some illustrative talk there, have since recanted their damning testimony. The liberal media, here we go, welcome bedfellows of those activists, blithely repeated the claims over and over, creating the impression that Davis was an innocent man and that his case proves that the death penalty is no longer acceptable public policy. Not so fast. Conspicuously absent from the activists' bald assertions and the media's quote-unquote reporting was the fact that a federal judge held an extensive post-trial evidentiary hearing on Davis's specific claims of innocence regarding each of those alleged recantations. Judge Moore's written ruling undercuts and eviscerates the advocates' claims that Davis was innocent. Judge Moore's ruling shows, among other things, that Davis was present during a drive-by shooting hours before the murder of Officer McPhail. Friends of Davis, who testified at trial, knew Davis to carry a handgun. The majority of the witnesses to the crime were African-American. Officer McPhail was white. One of the witnesses against Davis, who did not recant, was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. That's probably the guy that's not speaking. And Davis took the stand in his own trial and testified that he was present during the drive-by shooting the night before the murder, and that he changed his shirt between the drive-by and going to the Burger King, and that he was with 2 other men at the Burger King in the parking lot on the night Officer McPhail was murdered. All right, you know, of all this that's been said, there's nothing there that would solidify the case against him. Being present at a drive-by does not make you guilty of the drive-by. The fact that all the people there were black and the cop was white doesn't really solidify anything either. And being at the location where the second shooting took place, again, if you're with certain people that are doing bad things, it's quite possible they did 2 bad things and that you happened to be around for that and you got implicated. It's very possible. Davis blamed by implication his friend Mr. Coles for the murder. Don't forget Mr. Coles blamed him quite directly, too, so it's not so shocking. All witnesses at the trial pointed to Davis as a shooter except for one person who testified that Mr. Cole was the shooter. At trial, somebody testified that Mr. Cole was the shooter. This is something we didn't hear from the people that were supporting.
Interesting.
Yeah. The jury deliberated for only 2 hours before finding Davis guilty. Is this supposed to be a feather in their cap that they did it so quickly? You know, Southern justice oftentimes moves a little too fast. And that's certainly been the case over the years. Now, 2 decades after the murder, Davis claims that key witnesses have recanted. Well, it does take a long time sometimes for justice to be heard. And also, when you're facing a death penalty, your voice becomes a little louder. Judge Moore concluded that Mr. Davis's new evidence is largely smoke and mirrors. Furthermore, Judge Moore wrote that the vast majority of the evidence at trial remains intact, and the new evidence is largely not credible or lacking in probative value. Now, okay, the evidence remains intact. What evidence would that be? 7 of the 9 witnesses have recanted. 2 remain, one guy who's not saying anything, the other guy being the other suspect. There is no physical evidence tying him to the crime. So what evidence is it exactly that remains intact? I'd like to ask Judge Moore this. Of course, I can't speak to a judge. None of us can. So it's easy to say these things. When you start asking questions, a little bit more difficult. Now, as for the recantation evidence from the eyewitnesses, Judge Moore wrote that not all recantations are created equal, that Mr. Davis vastly overstates the value of his evidence of innocence. In other words, the judge ultimately determined that the overwhelming evidence of guilt produced at Mr. Davis's trial remained intact. I don't really understand what he means by not all recantations are created equal. I mean, I guess he didn't believe people when they said they were lying at first, that, no, you were telling the truth, even though now you say you were lying. How would you know that? How could you possibly know that? More damning is this. Of his 7 recantations, only one is a meaningful, credible recantation. Judge Moore found that 4 of the remaining 6 recantations were either not credible or not true recantations and should be disregarded. Well, you know what? Okay, if we're going to disregard the recantations, am I saying that word right? That's how you pronounce it, right? I've never said that word before, recantations.
Recantations.
Yes, it's not like recant. Yeah, okay, it's got to be right.
I just feel a little. Recantations?
I feel self-conscious because I don't want to pronounce a word I'm saying so often wrong. But okay, you're going to discard of 6 recantations. Then shouldn't you also disregard the 6 testimonies that these unreliable people, when they're saying one thing, gave at the trial? Because obviously they don't know what they're talking about. Fine. So then you have 1 that's meaningful and credible. Well, doesn't that introduce some doubt into the whole case? If there's a meaningful, credible recantation of what somebody said at trial, that certainly should be looked at seriously and not simply dismissed like what this judge appears to have done. Here's one of the more interesting parts of Judge Moore's ruling. The remaining 2 recantations were presented under the most suspicious of circumstances, with Mr. Davis intentionally preventing the validity of the recantation from being challenged in open court through cross-examination. I don't think someone on death row has that much power. I really don't. Judge Moore's written ruling was published and made public a long time ago. Anti-death penalty activists have known about the ruling since it came out. The media had access to the ruling from the moment it was published. Neither the activists nor the media mentioned Judge Moore's factual findings and conclusions of law. Okay, great. The activists, the media didn't do their job. They weren't strong enough. They weren't loud enough. And for this, someone has to die. That's basically what that paragraph is saying there, that because people didn't speak up loudly enough earlier, and because they're tying this to the anti-death penalty, making him the poster child, the whole thing is invalid. This is a guy who's in prison. And again, to bring up Mitnick, because he's somebody that we knew who was in prison for a long time, when you're in there, you don't really have access. You can't really do very much. It's very, very difficult to present a case. You're at the mercy of so many entities, so many people that have power. So it's quite logical that he didn't present the strongest case possible. It's quite possible that his lawyers had other things to do and didn't see him as a priority. It's entirely possible. Anyway, we don't have time to read the entire thing. It's on heritage.org, the rest of this piece. Raises a lot of questions that should be debated. But what's the point now? The guy's dead. We can't debate it anymore. It's over. But you know what? I don't think it is over. I think people can still look into this. I think investigations should still continue. And if there is credibility in the story of innocence, we should hold everybody who ruled against him, everybody who said, no, we're not even going to listen. Those guys should be charged with his death and put on trial for that. It's only fair. You know, if you're not going to give somebody a chance to be heard and condemn them to death, how is that different than just shooting them blindly because you feel like it, because you have the power to?
Perhaps it's an opportunity to reevaluate and reassess how we feel about the death penalty in general.
Most people support it.
As a society.
Most people support it, and this <I know. laughs> this should be, you know, this should really test that support, but more than anything.
It's still, you know, it's an opportunity here to not let this be entirely in vain.
Yeah, let's not make it, factions of one side or another. Let's look at this as an individual case. Forget who supports it and who's against it. Look at the individual case as someone who's not basically tied into it strongly. And ask yourself, is there a doubt? Is there a doubt that we maybe should look into a little bit more? Hey, we're out of time. I want to go out with a song that I think really is kind of apropos. Came out many years ago. Those of you my age probably remember this from junior high school or something like that. It was a big hit back in the 70s. And it talks about, guess what? Injustice in Georgia. Seems to always be around. All right, we'll see you next week again. OTW at 2600.com. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
He was on his way home from Candletop. Been 2 weeks gone, and he thought he'd stop at Webb's and have him a drink before he went home to her. Andy Wolo said hello, and he said, hi, what's doing, whoa? Said, sit down, I've got some bad news, it's gonna hurt. Said, I'm your best friend, and you know that's right. But your young bride ain't home tonight. Since you've been gone, she's been seeing that Amos boy, Seth. Well, he got mad, and he saw red. And Andy said, boy, don't you lose your head. Cause to tell you the truth, I've been with her myself. That's the night that the lights went out in Georgia. That's the night that they harmed an innocent man. Well, don't trust your soul and old backwoods southern lawyer. Cause the judge in the town's got bloodstains on his hands. Well, Andy got scared and left the bar, walking on home cause he didn't live far. See, Andy didn't have many friends and he just lost him one. Brother thought his wife must have left town, so he went home and finally found the only thing Papa had left him, and that was a gun. But he went off to Andy's house, slipping through the backwoods quiet as a mouse. Came upon some tracks too small for Andy to make. He looked through the screen at the back porch door, and he saw Andy lying on the floor in a puddle of blood. And he started to shake. Well, the Georgia patrol wasn't making their rounds, so he fired a shot just to flag them down. And a big belly champ grabbed his gun and said, why'd you do it? And the judge said guilty in a make-believe trial. Slapped the sheriff on the back with a smile. Said, supper's waiting at home and I gotta get to it. That's the night that the lights went out in Georgia. That's the night that they harmed an innocent man. Well, don't trust your soul to no backwoods southern lawyer. Cause the judge in the town's got bloodstains on his hands. Well, they hung my brother before I could say the tracks he saw while on his way to Andy's house and back that night were mine. His cheating wife had never left town, and that's one body that'll never be found. See, little sister don't miss when she aims her gun. That's the night that the lights went out in Georgia. Oh, oh, oh. That's the night that they haunted it.
Kids, Finn's Revolution right here. My name is Finn. I'm with you till 9 p.m. right here on WUSB. Stony Brook, We're going to be giving away some tickets tonight to the movies, and we're going to celebrate a little bit, I think, the birthday of Mr. Robbie Shakespeare. So stay tuned for all that.